The reality for many of you is that investment properties where you live have become absolutely unaffordable. The good news is that there are many cities with affordable properties, and a lot of those cities, believe it or not, have properties for under 100K. If you're someone who's ready to buy your first property out of state in the next 4 months, I encourage you to apply to my out-of-state coaching program. I purchased properties out of state, and it's absolutely changed my life completely. The same is possible for you too. You simply need the right information. That's all it takes. My program will provide you the hands-on support and a step-by-step process to buy that first property within 4 months. So go to outofstatemoney.com to apply today. Again, outofstatemoney.com to apply today, and I look forward to talking to you soon.
Excuse me, may I talk to you for a second?
Yes. This is the Black Real Estate Dialogue. And the purpose of the Black Real Estate Dialogue is to document the journey of an up-and-coming real estate investor and to share the stories of successful Black real estate investors. So you want to start a podcast, huh? Well, we got something to help you. The Black Real Estate Dialogue brings you the How to Start a Successful Podcast on a Budget with No Experience ebook and webinar bundle.
We are controlling transmission.
Come and put info into action as we show you the step-by-step process to sharing your successful podcast on a budget. This bundle is full of the exact details, social media hacks, and podcasting process we've used to gain 13,000 downloads and over 10,000 Instagram followers. But that's not all. As a bonus, you'll receive the exact super trackers we use to stay organized and free access to our private Facebook group designed to help you execute. Make sure you click that link now because there is an audience for you to reach. The How to Start a Successful Podcast on a Budget with No Experience, the ebook and webinar bundle presented by the Black Real Estate Dialogue. Do you really think investing in real estate is too expensive? Well, you wrong about that. Presenting a beginner's guide to buying your first out-of-state property, a Black Real Estate Dialogue course. That's right, it's the new course presented by the Black Real Estate Dialogue, teaching you how to develop the investor's mindset, the advantages of investing out of state, getting your finances in order, finding the right location, assembling your team, creating financing strategies, how to find and analyze properties, how to find tenants, real-life case studies, and so much more in bonus content.
Oh yeah, did we mention you have lifetime access?
My goodness! If you have dreams of buying a property out of state but have no idea where to start, well, this is the guide for you. Learn the tips from someone with firsthand experience. Are you looking for a community of like-minded individuals and access to experts in real estate?
Yeah.
Are you interested in real estate but need more support and guidance?
You know who it is?
The Black Real Estate Dialogue presents the Real Estate Investing Community. No matter how much or how little real estate experience you have, we've created a community for you because your perspective is important. All right, tell me, where's the number one place where you can do Q&A with experienced guest speakers 2 times per month? How about unlimited access to past guest speakers' recordings? What about a private Slack channel to engage in daily discussion with everybody in the community to share resources and support each other? Head on over to blackrealestatedialogue.com. That's blackrealestatedialogue.com. It's the real estate investing community presented by the Black Real Estate Dialogue. Come join us today.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast, episode 71. A couple quick announcements before we get into this week's episode. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe on whichever platforms you're listening to this on. Also, please be sure to leave a rating and review. It will help us move up in the rankings and also to reach more people. So thank you in advance for helping us out in that way. If you want to gain early access to episodes, bonus content, discounts on merch, and more, join our Patreon program, visit patreon.com/blackrealestatedialogue or visit the link in the show notes. This episode is sponsored by the Bread Real Estate Investing Community. If you're looking for a group of like-minded individuals and exclusive access to experienced real estate investors, look no further. Each month, we have 2 masterclasses that are taught by experienced investors in various areas of real estate. You have unlimited access to past guest speaker recordings. You also have access to our private Slack channel to engage in daily discussion with everyone in the community, to share resources, and also to support one another. Definitely something you don't want to miss out on. The price is only $1 per day. So if you're interested, go to blackrealestatedialogue.com and you'll be able to find all of the information. This episode is one that I'm really excited about. It's a space that our people are really not in. And so I don't want to spoil it for you. So without further ado, let's get into it.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. I'm very excited for this episode. It's been a long time coming. Here with me today, I have Ibrahim Badness out of Nashville, Tennessee. Ibrahim, thank you so much for joining the show. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Been listening and, you know, I'm really, really impressed by all the guests that you have and the content that you cover. So I'm honored to be here.
Definitely. I appreciate it. So Ibrahim, to start off, could you just share more with the people about who you are, where you're from, and what you do?
Yeah. So originally from Chicago, my parents are, you know, of Nigerian descent. So first generation Nigerian American here, and kind of learned a lot of things, you know, firsthand, you know, the hard way. So, you know, I was lucky enough to be good at basketball growing up in Chicago. God, that enabled me to get an education at, you know, a good institution like Bucknell University. And then I leveraged that just to continue to play. And then, you know, sports has been such a big part of my life. And, you know, after playing, I had a 4-year little stint of playing basketball after college. And then after that, I really didn't know what I was going to do. So naturally, I just started training kids in basketball, and a few connections that I had, mutual friend here and there, connected me with someone who was looking for a manager for their sports facility that they just purchased, you know, a few years prior. And it's my first job. I was like, sure, I'll take it. And that's kind of what got me into the sports facility industry. You know, I'm still in, you know, real estate. I do commercial real estate, but, you know, the focus of today is really just to be talk a little bit about that sports facility industry and my experience in that industry, because it was, even though it was a brief 4 or 5 years, it was a wild ride.
Definitely. That's awesome. That's awesome. So you played at Bucknell. What was that experience like playing college basketball?
Oh, it was great. You know, I went to a school that not many people heard of until, you know, when I was in high school. So people had a hard time pronouncing it and didn't know where Lewisburg, Pennsylvania was. And I didn't know what I was getting into. I just knew I was going to play. Mm-hmm. So I went to visit. I knew I was going to play, and I went committed. And we were actually lucky enough to just have a lot of really good players at the same time. We got to the tournament a few times. We actually upset Kansas 1 year. Wow. Then the next year we upset Arkansas. So and then, you know, throughout that time, we upset a lot of other teams. Not in the actual tournament, but, you know, we beat Pittsburgh when they were number 5 in the country. When this is when they had, you know, Chris Taft and Carl Krauser. I don't know if you, I'm really dating myself with those names, but we beat Syracuse when they had Jerry McNamara.
Wow.
Up there. And that's kind of honestly what was kind of the fodder for my, like, the next step for me after playing professionally.
Very cool. Very cool. Wow. You guys are out here just bursting bubbles.
Yeah.
Exploding brackets.
Yeah. Yeah. People weren't too happy with us, except for like this, like, if you look at like the people who were really pleased with us, it was like purely geographical. Everybody on the East Coast was all about Bucknell, then everybody else was, you know, rooting for Kansas.
Definitely. That's funny. That's funny. And then as far as professionally, where'd you play at?
So after college, I went, it's a little, not as simple of a story, but I actually got to play in the D League at the time. It was called the D League. Mm-hmm. It's now called the G League. So I played for the Tulsa 66ers. Didn't really work out there for a lot of different reasons. So they sent me back home. Then I got into coaching for a year. I coached at the Division I school, St. Francis University in Pennsylvania, because the head coach there was a guy who recruited me to Bucknell when I was in high school. So I got that role and I realized I don't like coaching. So then I got back into playing. So then I went to Germany. And then after that, I went to Brazil.
Nice. Any memories stand out from your time playing professional basketball?
Oh, my gosh. We could have a whole podcast dedicated to that, but I don't want to do that to you. I'll tell you this, you know, I was also fortunate enough to play for my country, Nigeria. So I was 19, 20 years old. I think it was my first time playing with the team. And I was really lucky that I had already been to Nigeria prior to that with my family. So the cool thing about it at that time, I don't know if they do this now, but we actually trained in Nigeria. So they flew all of us there and we spent the whole summer training for the camp. And then we, you know, built all that up to play in the African Cup is what they call it, which was actually in Algeria at the time. Oh gosh, I think this was 2007. I want to say, I'm my memory's getting clouded, but uh, that, that that was an incredible memory. So the one story I'll tell you is we played in Algeria to play in the African Cup, and the top three teams make it to the Olympics. The World Championships the following year. So we were playing for the third place game because we lost the one game prior. So the third place game was a big deciding game because the loser doesn't get to go. So the team we actually ended up playing was Algeria. So we were playing Algeria in their own country, and the stakes are the winner plays in the World Championships. It was a crazy, crazy game. We actually ended up winning it. We pulled it out. Wow. And the cool part about it, well, this isn't so cool, I could talk about it now, but after the game, they were so angry with us, people started trying to pick fights with us. So what ended up happening was a big fight broke out between one of our teammates who was kind of a hothead, and they actually, the police actually escorted all of us back to our locker room, and we stayed there for the next 6 hours because they wanted all the fans to get out because they were afraid that something bad would happen to us. So that's the one story. I was like 19 or 20, and I was praying for my life. And I always said, if I ever live to tell this story, I'm going to tell every chance I get. So that's the one story.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So sports facilities, you mentioned that you got a job as a manager at the sports facility. So can you talk about what that experience was like, and I guess how you end up being involved in developing sports facilities?
Yeah. So this role was primarily an operations role. So we can talk more about the development piece, but this role, I was, you know, in a pre-existing facility. The manager, the owner, actually had another business. She owned like a daycare, which is a really good business. If you guys, if you ever want to dig into that, I'm sure you could find someone in that world. But that's a really good business. So, and she was wasn't very versed in that kind of industry. So she hired a consultant, and that's kind of how I got involved. And my role was primarily like before I got the role, all I knew was training. I didn't know anything about, you know, the business side of it. But, you know, when you get in there, you learn quickly. Those are long days. You're working weekends. Weekends and nights are primarily where you're making your money. And you know, any other point is just really planning. So if you're there in the morning, you're planning, right? You're not going to get much activity. So they call these peak and non-peak hours. So a peak hour is pretty much 5 to 9 on the weekday, and basically, you know, 7 to 10 on the weekend. That's primarily when you're working. So if you're someone who's got kids or married, it's probably not the best role for you if you're willing to sacrifice that. But that's primarily most people that you see working in the facility. Those are the hours that they're working. And they're dealing with, depending on the type of facilities that they have, they're dealing with a nonstop action. It's, you know, when it's peak hours, it's nonstop action. And there's a lot of things that could happen. So you always got to be alert because the big thing that, you know, the big elephant in the room is injuries, right? When you get kids playing sports, whether it's soccer or basketball or volleyball or futsal or baseball, what have you, an injury is just a second away. So you always stay on alert, making sure safety is the number one primary, you know, concern. And really, that was kind of the whole ordeal for us. We just made sure people were safe. But the hardest part, to be honest with you, is getting people into the facility, right? Once they're there and you're just maintaining, making sure people are safe and healthy, then you're just bankrolling. You know what I mean? That's kind of the beauty of the industry. But the hardest part is actually getting people there. So that requires a lot of upfront work and planning. And that's kind of how I got into my next role. So we can talk about that if you want, but I'll let you dictate.
Yeah. Let's dig into that. So you started with operation, and it seems like you got a ton of great experience from there. So I guess what was the next stage of that part of your career after the operations side of it?
Yeah, so I was really lucky. I had a good friend who was connected to a developer in Pennsylvania who was near my college town, and you know, heard of me, and they said, "Oh, Abe is in the sports facility industry. Great, because I'm about to build one." So he contacted me. Went through a few interviews. I didn't think I did too well in the interviews, but he hired me, and I was really lucky. And this guy, you know, just to kind of give you some context, is over $500 million in net worth that he has. So he lives in this really small town in Pennsylvania, owns a lot of real estate, is in a lot of different projects, very diverse portfolio. Really, really smart guy, relatively young too, and really empowers people. That's the one thing I have a great deal of respect for him. So he brought me on. He trained me under another consulting firm. And there's a ton of these in this industry. A consulting firm that was going to help with the pre-opening, procedures. And then after that, the plan was they were going to help manage the building. But as I was doing my training, I started to, you know, develop a little bit of an aptitude, and, you know, I showed him that I knew what I was doing. He actually got rid of the consulting company and said, this is your baby, you know, take the keys and run with it. So I basically planned the whole, you know, the whole outfit. So I got there when there was a pre-existing building that we were going to demolish. That's when I got there. I got there before the demo. So the full demo and rebuild is going to take about a year and some change. So probably 13, 14 months. And I was there for 13 months prior to grand opening. I had that whole year to plan. I had the whole year. And this is generally how long it takes when you're talking about building a facility from scratch, essentially. So we demoed it. We, you know, worked with the construction company, architects, and all of that good stuff. Had weekly construction meetings. We're talking everything from, you know, what kind of steel we're putting in there to what the slab is going to be. And then, you know, we get to the part, you know, that everyone probably likes is, you know, the financing, right? So once you in an ordeal like that, it really has less to do with science and more to do with art, to believe it or not. So when you have a facility and you have like this, you know, if you have your real estate in order, then all that really, the next step is just figuring out what the financing is going to be. And when it comes to that, there's a lot of ways you can cut this and slice this up. The way that, you know, our boss, the owner, decided to do it was through what a lot of people call a public-private partnership, or also known as a P3. So in the industry, they call it a P3. I know, I'm sure you probably brought this up at some point in your podcast, but, you know, P3s are very, very popular in the sports facility industry. And they're popular primarily for one reason. There's very little debt service to the operator. So if there isn't a P3, that means you got a large debt service. Because, I mean, you're talking the money it costs to build a facility, the money it costs to outfit the facility, and then obviously the money it costs to operate the facility once it's being built. All of that, a lot of upfront costs. You're talking, you know, $100 to $300 per square foot when you consider all of that. You know, you kind of put all that into, you know, one big equation. So being able to work with a municipality is paramount in situations like this, because what they bring is really the tax power. They have the ability to finance things outside of just charging you something. So they have the land and they say, well, there's going to be some sort of economic impact on this particular piece of land. So we'll cut you a deal, whether it be tax abatements, tax incremented funding, or just straight up saying, hey, we're going to pull this money from hotel revenue, right? So that's another, you know, strategy that a lot of municipalities use. So you get all that stuff in order. You do get loaning. You do get debt financing. However, it's not as much when you have a municipality involved. So you're basically building like a capital stack here. You can also go for grants and stuff like that. A lot of people go for different types of federal grants because sports facilities enhance health and wellness. And there's a lot of, you know, initiatives from the federal government to kind of fund those types of activities. So you're building this capital stack. The goal is to get as little debt financing as possible. And once you have that, then you got to do all of the, you know, approvals from the actual municipality. So you're going in front of city council, you're telling them what you're doing, and you're getting all the different ordinances that they put into place. And that is a very painstaking process because they have rules depending on the municipality. They have rules for what color the outside should look like, you know, earth tones or, you know, a certain type of color that matches the city flag or what have you. So you go through all of that, a lot of deliberation. And really, that was probably the most frustrating part of the whole ordeal. And then really on my end, when you get all that stuff in place, then it's really just planning out what's this going to look like? You know, how are we going to outfit this place? You know, what are we going to put in here? So when it comes to that kind of stuff, you really got to determine a few things, what your geographic area is, because sports vary from geographical locations. So if you're on the East Coast, you're probably going to have, you know, on the young boys side, probably going to have a ton of baseball and basketball. And, you know, lacrosse, perhaps, maybe, and then soccer. And then on the girls' side, you're going to have a lot of softball, especially on the East Coast, a lot of lacrosse. And then you're going to have a lot of soccer. Basketball doesn't get the best athletes when it comes to young girls. So these are the type of things that come into play.
Couple follow-up questions. You dropped some things in there that we haven't discussed on the show yet.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
No, you're good. You're good. There's a whole lot of game. So could you define like what a P, I think it was P3 you said, and also a cap stack. Those are two terms that we haven't had anybody like share.
Sure.
Just so, like in your words, just define those.
Yeah. So a P3 is basically, I'll take a step back. When I want to start a sports facility, any kind of initiative. So that involves real estate, I can either self-fund it. I can get bank funding, private equity funding, right? Or I can work with a government, right? In order to help me, a federal government, maybe that's municipality, state, maybe even the federal government, depending on what that all that could be. And once you add a third party in there, that's generally when they call it a public-private partnership, right? So the public part is really the government that you work. The private part is you, right? You, the one that wants to start this sports facility. And sometimes it's the other way around. The municipality actually wants to start the facility, but doesn't have the wherewithal, the know-how to actually build it and operate it. So then they go out and hunt out private company in order to do the operations. So the public-private part, really one doesn't come before the other. It's just when both sides come together for this common goal of building something that has some sort of good to their community. So that's basically what I mean by a public-private partnership. So the nuts and bolts of all of that can vary from place to place. So when I say like there was one situation where, you know, one deal that we did where the municipality lent all this acreage for $1 a square foot, leased it for $1 a square foot to the private company, $1 a square foot per year, right? Which is basically they had to charge something, right? So, I mean, they couldn't just give it free, so they charged something. But in return, they were guaranteeing a certain amount of revenue and economic impact that was coming into that city. So they knew they were going to make it up on the back end. You see this a lot with big, you know, arenas and things like that in professional sports, right? So this is no different, just a little bit smaller scale. So that's primarily what I mean by a P3. And then a capital stack is essentially when you are planning a project that has big economic implications. You need to be able to finance it in a variety of ways. So a very, very simple capital stack is just saying, all right, I'm getting debt from so-and-so bank for this kind of interest rate over this many years. That's a simple capital stack, right? Another one would be, hey, I'm putting a certain amount of equity down myself, getting some more money from the bank. And then I'm also getting grants, right? In order to use, and I'm using all that capital to fund this project, okay? So I've seen some very, very creative capital stacks when it comes to sports facilities, because frankly, when people really want something to get done, they're going to find ways, right? Maybe a bank says, this is as much as we'll give you for this kind of property. Maybe the city says, all right, well, we'll throw in this much. Then, you know, equity provider says we'll throw in this much. Everybody who has, if they have all have a vested interest in building this, it's usually going to get done and they find creative ways to do it. For instance, so I don't know if you've, you know, the LeBron James, I Promise School, that's actually a P3. Some of that is funded from taxes that the state, collects from its constituents. So there's a lot of really creative ways I've seen people fund projects like this.
Definitely. That's amazing. That's amazing. So you're a newbie and they basically just gave you the keys and tell you to run with it.
I'm as shocked as you are, man. I'm as shocked as you are. But I tell you this, I took it with great humility. So one thing I did, because, you know, once you get all of that stuff we just talked about out the way, you got to get people in the building, right? We had to plan and see what actually was going to work in this particular area. So, and this is that part of the process that a lot of people kind of overlook, and we call it a feasibility study. So when it comes to, and they do this in a lot of different industries, hotels primarily is where the feasibility studies are huge. When they build franchises and stuff like that, they do a lot of feasibility studies. But you collect market data. There's a lot of great services out there. ESRI is a good one. They collect market data on different geographic areas, and they tell you what's the median household income of these people. Do they have enough discretionary income to support these programs that you're going to start, you know, having in your facility? So they do that. There's a ton of data out there. The company that I work for after this, we could talk about them later. They're the market leader in feasibility study. You know, they pump out about 50, 60 feasibility studies a year. Frankly, a lot of cities and states and municipalities are looking for visitors. So just in case no one knew, cities actually don't make a ton of money from taxes, right? The real money is where you get visitors, people coming into your city to spend money in your hotels and your gas stations and in your restaurants. That's really where the money is being made when it comes to, city revenue. It's really visitation revenue. So like Paris, one of the largest, you know, I think it's the most visited place in the world, right? They get a ton of visitor revenue because you got people people staying at Airbnbs and they're going to visit the Louvre and they're eating at their nice restaurants and they're going to see the Eiffel Tower, right? So just tons of money pumping into that city and they can use that to do really cool projects and stuff like that. So anyway, I don't want to, but feasibility studies are really, really, really cool because you can basically, the numbers will tell you whether the facility is going to work or not. And one of the cool things that they do is they check out competition. So they really check the competitive landscape. The rule of thumb is that you don't have a facility more than a radius around 25 to 50 miles. Because basically, if you have more than that, you're saturating the market and really nobody wins. We're basically eating from the same plate, right? So you really want to separate yourself when it comes to having a sports facility. There are some markets that are just so large that you can afford to have that. You can have special types of facilities. So we've seen that too. But when you do a feasibility study, you're digging in, finding median household income. You're finding out how many people actually live there. You're finding out how many and what age are these people that live there? Are these younger families, older families, right? And then you're saying, where do they actually spend their money now? So they actually dig and pull data from online sales for stuff, fitness equipment and things like that. Wow. to determine whether or not people will be apt to spend their money and their discretionary income in your sports facility. So you do all of that. And those cost a ton of money, by the way. Feasibility studies, that's a big, good business to get into because you're basically just pulling data all day. But you do that, right? And then you figure out, okay, well, we know these people spend this. We know they like to play these sports. So this is what we're going to build. So in the one facility in Pennsylvania, we had indoor turf. We had basketball courts. Really, I just say hard courts. We don't really say basketball. We say hard courts, turf. And then we had a FEC, what they call a family entertainment center. So think of Chuck E. Cheese. It's probably the largest FEC concept in the world, right? So you have FEC, turf courts, hard courts. And on those courts, there's a ton of things you can do. So generally, turf yields more per square foot than hard courts. And then FECs yield more than turf generally. So we had basically the best of everything. And we put the basketball in there really because I wanted some hard courts in there. And it didn't actually end up making us any money, but I put it in there because I was a basketball guy. So when you have that, then you started to plan out, you got your surfaces. Now you started to plan out, what can I do on these surfaces? And the really cool thing about sports facilities is that all these surfaces are so transitory. So on a hard court, I could play basketball, I could play volleyball, I could play futsal, right? Those are the three main sports. Then you in the wintertime, you get indoor field hockey if you have an area that has a lot of people who play field hockey. And then you have other, sports like wheelchair basketball, right? We have that quite a bit. We had so many different types of events in there. We had wrestling matches in there, right? All of these things you could consider as potential yield opportunities for this surface. So when we talk about surfaces, people in the facility industry, they don't talk basketball or baseball or anything. They just talk about surfaces. What is this surface going to get me? How transitory is this surface? What else can I use it for? Because like we all know, there's 24 hours in the day. And, if you're only running out four hours a day during the week and then 13 hours on the weekend, like you got to really maximize that. Right. So you got to make sure a lot of people are in this facility at all times. So some of the most creative people, I think, are the people in the sports facility industry because they use their creativity to dynamically change what the use of the surfaces are for.
Wow. Wow. That's so crazy because everybody who's listening to this has some concept of what a sports facility is. Some maybe right. Your athletes, or you probably had one in your town or city where you lived at.
Sure.
And I never thought about all this stuff. Like it seems like it's a very meticulous and data-driven process, especially as you mentioned, just, doing the feasibility studies, like, looking at the demographics, what they do, what they spend money on. I never connected the two and thought that information would feed into the design and ultimately what a sports complex in a particular city would look like. So that's pretty crazy, but it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I mean, there's always this good saying I always heard where there's mystery, there's margin, and like there's a ton of mystery. And once you, figure all of that stuff out, there's a lot of margin to be made. But generally, this is probably not well known either, but sports facilities, the best ones are just breaking even, to be honest with you. There's very few that are really blowing it out of the water. And we can talk a little bit about why that is. But the truth of the matter is, there's only so many hours in the day. You're almost playing from behind, right? When you have a sports facility. So you got to plan meticulously, because if you don't, you're losing out on these hours that you can never get back, right? So if I got a Monday from 5 to 9 and I don't fill it, I'll never get that Monday back, right? I got to maximize for that Monday. So I got to fill it. And the way a lot of people fill it are a few ways. We talked about some of the actual sports that you can play, but then you got to talk about programming piece of it. So there's generally three types of things you can do. You can have a league, which is the most consistent. You can have a tournament, which is also fairly consistent. Or you can have programming, which could be a lesson, maybe a group lesson or what have you. And then lastly, you can have your rentals, which is basically saying, hey, this is the space, pay me for it, do whatever you want on the time with that time on that space. So sports facility operators have to decide between those four on every single dollar per, or actually a space per hour or per minute or per unit, whatever unit you want to use to measure. But they have to decide on that, because if they don't, really they're, like I said, you'll never get that back. Yeah. So some people allot certain hours for rentals and say, put it on their website, hey, this is for rentals, you know when to rent it, boom. Some people allot certain hours for leagues, and you know, that's pretty clear. Some people allot hours for tournaments, and tournaments primarily happen on the weekends. So a really good facility, there's some really good ones, all over the country, but you know, I've seen ones that just do all rentals. So all they do literally is just collect the check and say, here, don't get hurt, you know, we'll watch over you, but they're not operating anything, right? They're just basically a landlord. Here you are, here's the time, you know, they rent it. That's a really good model. It's a lazy model, right? But it's a really good model, because there's very little liability in that, right? You're not worried about if someone's going to fill it or not. If they're there, they're there. Great. I've seen people have a little mix of everything, but I think the best leagues, in my opinion, the best places have a good mix of leagues and tournaments. Mm-hmm. I saw there was a facility that I was helping out with. It was 200,000 square feet. So wow. Pretty big, turf fields all over. I mean, they did more than a million in tournaments a year, and more than a million in leagues a year, right? It's an exceptionally well-run organization. But you got to think, leagues are, it's a community product, right? Yeah. When you have a league, your people who are constituents in that town, they're coming every week. You know they're coming, right? They're coming on schedule because you have a schedule for them. And that's at least 8 to 10 weeks of guaranteed revenue, right? Which is a really, really, you know, reliable product to have. That's why a lot of facilities go leagues on the weekdays, because it's a very reliable product. You go adult leagues, youth leagues, doesn't matter. As long as I can say 10 weeks out of the year, I know this is going to be filled. That's perfect. And generally they break the year up in 4 or 5 pieces. So when you get, you know, you got 50 some odd weeks in the year, you can break that up into 10 different or 5 different pieces. You know, you got 10 weeks. That's 1/5 of my year, that space is covered. I'm good, yeah. Right? That's a great problem to have. Like when you know that it's actually not a problem. It's a great benefit to have. Because you know, not only will you make money on them coming in for the league, but you also make money when they need to get a Gatorade, right? In your concessions, or when they want to get fries or chips or anything like that. So it's a really, really consistent product. One of the more lucrative products, in my opinion, are tournaments, which are primarily run on weekends. So when you have a tournament, the reason why it's so lucrative is because you're charging a premium for a very small amount of time. So in a league, you know, I get you paying me, you know, you pay me up front for a certain amount of time, and you're coming over the course of 10 weeks. In a tournament, you pay me a certain amount, a premium amount, to play maybe one game, maybe two games, maybe three games, right? The better teams are going to probably make out better than we will, but the bad teams won't make out at all, because they'll maybe lose a few games and they're out of the tournament, right? And then you get a ton of highly concentrated visitors. When you have tournaments, you have parents, grandparents, cousins, uncles, they all come to watch. And they're all eating at the concession stand, right? And they're all staying at hotels, right? And they're all traveling with their rental cars. So this is all really good stuff for the community, for the city. And this is why it's so lucrative, because not only are you making money from the tournament, but you're also making money on ancillary ways, concessions. You're making money from rebates that you might have with certain restaurants, right? You're making money from rebates with hotels. That's a big piece of revenue in the sports facility industry. So generally what happens is, I say I'm running a tournament on this weekend. Mm-hmm. I know I'm going to get, I already have 100 teams scheduled to come, right? I'm actually have the, this, they call this having holding rights to a tournament. So I'm a rights holder to the tournament. I can go to a hotel and people, if some of the people who might have, you know, soccer teams or whatever, this is, dude, you go ahead and do this because the hotels, listen, I have 100 teams coming. I'm guaranteeing they're coming. They don't know where to stay. Like now, so you go to a, maybe a visitor's bureau. That's one way you can go do it. But visitor's bureau basically works for the state or the city, and they're funded all by hotel tax revenue. So you can go to visitor's bureau and they can set it up for you. Or you go to a specific hotel that you like, or maybe, you know, you have a relationship with, and you say, for every room you book, I want $10 back and 10% of every single room. And this is, that's very standard in this industry. So you get your 10 and 10 is what they call it. Most I've seen 10 and 25. I've seen 20 and 25, right? So you get your $10, 10% for every room that's booked, because I know that they're registering for my tournament. And the hotel will gladly do that because hotels struggle on weekends, right? They struggle with visit. They struggle to get people in on weekends. They succeed on the weekdays because they get a lot of business travel. But on the weekends is where they struggle. And this is why some hotels have sales roles primarily for youth sports. And that's all they do. They connect with teams and rights holders and make sure that they're collecting, making sure these teams are coming to their place and not somewhere else.
Man, my mind is kind of blown right now because I played basketball growing up through high school. And, you know, we play all over the place. I'm from Brooklyn, New York originally. We played all over the place. You know, we pay our little $5, $10 to play here, play there. But I kind of wish I knew about like the operations of it and these kind of things when I was a kid. I mean, who knows, just to know, or maybe I would have tried to be in that industry. I mean, I like sports. So, man, this is some great information.
Yeah, no, it was a great time. You know, I learned a ton. I learned a ton about business. I think the biggest misconception is when you walk into a huge facility, you automatically think that they're making money, right? Because it's so big, and maybe you come in a really busy day, like, man, this place is wild. Go in there on a Tuesday morning, go in there on a Tuesday afternoon. I'm sure you could probably hear the phone ring in that facility, right? Because generally they struggle with that. And then the hardest time for any facility by far, hands down, especially an indoor facility, is the summer because it's so nice outside. So generally what you have is you have to build camp products. That falls under the programming category. So when you build camp products, you're basically trying to make sure it's in and of itself a very competitive market, summer camps. So, I mean, you're competing with band camp, you know, you're competing with reading camp, and, you know, maybe you have a famous sports player who has a camp or whatever, day camp at, you know, maybe a specific, you know, place. So there's tons of competition. So youth sports facilities are trying to find creative ways to get people in the doors in the summer when it's hot, even though they know no one wants to be indoors during the summertime, right? So it's a very, very competitive time. And generally, that's where you see a dip in revenue for generally every single facility, except for the weekends. Because as you mentioned, when you're on a travel team, that's generally when they go. They travel in the summertime, and that's generally where you kind of make up a ton of money on that end. But weekdays, very barren. Barren is really, really barren.
Got it. So I guess as far as your career, where did things go after you were working with that organization?
Yeah. So I got a call from a friend who was a part of the consulting company that had trained me. He had moved on to a bigger firm, which is like, it's like the firm in the industry. I kind of give them a shout out. They're called Sports Facility Advisory, SFA. They have two arms. They have SFA and SFM, Sports Facility Management. So, and I'm giving all their trade secrets away, but I'm not in the industry anymore. So they, what SFA does, the SFA arm is basically all feasibility studies. They're hunting down people, private companies, municipalities that want to build facilities. It could be anything from a swimming pool to a park, to an outdoor park with a playground, or a huge multiplex facility, or a fitness center. It doesn't matter. Like, they want you, they want your business, right? And they're telling you basically, we're going to make sure you succeed by doing this, like the front end work, which is digging in on the data and finding out what you should and shouldn't have, what price points should be, all of that good stuff. So that's SFA. And SFM is really the management side, the consulting side, where they basically send a few dedicated individuals out on a project and make sure from beginning to end that it's being, you know, kept well. And then, you know, if the you know, company wants to continue, then we have the, you know, consulting side where we put a dedicated person in the facility with you basically throughout the duration of, you know, that you have. So SFA, SFM is very, very popular in that world because they do both. A few companies just do one. So there's another company, I think it's called Hungden, does a ton of feasibility studies. I think they're out of Chicago. And then they're charging 50, 60K per feasibility study. So, some of these municipalities gladly pay that because they want to know, they don't want to have a mistake. They want to make sure this is a sure thing. So they pay that money up front. So I went to SFA and was put on a project in Dallas, which was incredible. I worked with a really big time NBA star who was former NBA star. I don't want to really say his name. I didn't ask for his permission or anything. So he wanted to build a facility and really start building a number of them. Because he was a big name, he really can get into a lot of doors that, a general person just couldn't. So his ability to get into a lot of doors with his name really enabled us to grow a lot faster, even prior to pre-opening than most facilities would grow. So he was able to get land from DFW, which is, I don't know if anyone knows the DFW airport. A lot of people know him as an airport, but they have a whole different arm that does a ton of work on the development side. I mean, wow. They finance hotels. They have a ton of land, DFW. And they're basically, their long-term goal is basically to build another city around the airport. They've financed a ton of hotels. They're doing really, really well in that area, parking lots and things of that nature. So they have all this land. They actually leased the land to this guy, which is not easy to do, not easy to get land from DFW. And he built this facility right by the airport. So it was a perfect location because his goal was to run national tournaments, to get people to fly in and get a ton of visitors. And they stay at those hotels and all that. So to have somewhere right by the hotel, right by the airport is just perfect. So we were on that mission to build. And, his whole thing was basketball. And, we opened his eyes. I wouldn't say just me, but the team opened his eyes to the other products that you can have and other sports you can offer within the facility. And when you have space, because he had a big facility, I think it was about 120,000 square feet, maybe a little bit more. But he had all of these rooms that were unoccupied. So what we did is we went ahead and found operators. We went and found a cryo company to come in and fill one of the facilities. We went and found a masseuse to come and fill in one of the other facilities. All of these sports recovery type products and offerings we wanted to have. And then this is all him. He got a big deal with a local hospital, children's hospital there, and got that partnership, which really just kind of set him apart from just about anybody in the country. So that was my next project. And that, I worked to the bone, and it was a very, very, strenuous process because you're dealing with high profile people. Really big names come through, and I gave tours to and things like that because the facility was just going to be that large on scale. So we put in a ton of hours, and that was really my last bit. After that project, I was asked to go to Connecticut, and that's kind of when I was like, I think I'm good to move on and try something else. But yeah, that was pretty much the pinnacle of my career, where I was pretty much doing it at the highest level, and I felt like I've done what I needed to do.
Definitely, that's amazing. So when you compared that project to the previous one that we discussed in the beginning, what are some differences? Did geography play a difference? So like Pennsylvania, I believe, to Texas, did that play a part in similarities or differences? And also, was there anything you learned from the first project that kind of helped you as you started the next one?
Yeah. So I think that project that I had in Pennsylvania was the main word was planning, planning and building relationships. That was the key. And that's really what set us apart. I failed to mention this, but that product, that project that I did enabled us to build another part of our business, which was our own consulting side. And that's kind of why I got the role with SFA. But we built a consulting side because other municipalities said, hey, like, we hear about this facility here in Williamsport. Like, we want to do the same thing. So we would charge them, in order and basically show them the way, give them the playbook and the map. So the big difference in the project in Dallas was just scale, and honestly, I think the biggest, I'm going to backtrack a little bit. The number one difference is talent, in my opinion. We had to find the best talent because competition is fierce in a big metropolis like Dallas. So he was not the only show in town. And like I mentioned earlier, you generally want to keep a 25-mile radius. Like, they don't care about that in Dallas. I mean, there's facilities going up all over the place because it's very balkanized. They basically have a ton of different little cities within the big metropolitan metropolis metropolis of Dallas. So you got, you know, you got Irving, then you got Grapevine, and then you got, you know, Arlington, and then Frisco, and every single one of those has 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe facilities in those places. And they're all competing, and they know they're competing, but they got so many people there, they all can eat, you know? So that's kind of the difference between that and this. So when it came to this, it's all about talent retention. You know, you got to get talent, because the only reason people are going to come through the door is if they have the best coaches. His whole methodology was build programming inside. So he wanted his own travel teams. He didn't want to rent as much. He wanted his own tournaments, everything he wanted to own. He wanted everything to be in-house, he wanted to generate all the revenue. He didn't want to pay anybody to operate on his space. So when you have that, you need talent. You need people to say, I'm leaving this facility because this is the best volleyball coach in town, right? I'm leaving this because it's the best basketball coach in town. And honestly, that's what he did. So we went and, you know, paid a lot for a lot of, you know, really talented, you know, sports specific roles, and was able to, you know, pull market share slowly from some of these competitors within the area. But I think that hands down is the biggest difference. You're dealing with, you have bigger salaries, but then you also have bigger personalities, which, you know, is a whole different, you know, conversation. But that was hands down the biggest difference.
Got it. And as far as size, just to give people some context, how large was the complex that in Pennsylvania, and how large was the one in Texas?
So Texas, I believe, was 120,000 square feet, which isn't that big of a facility. You know, when you're talking about, you know, I mean, there's, I think the largest one in America, I think today still is Spooky Nook, which is also in Pennsylvania. It's in near Harrisburg. And that is close to 1 million square feet, probably a little bit more. Yeah, it's the largest in America. Largest in America, yeah. And they actually have a hotel attached to the facility. So they're making hotel money on top of the sports facility money. And then they have like the U.S. field hockey team is like, that's the home of U.S. field hockey. So partnerships all over the place there. But the facility in Williamsport was about 70,000 square feet. So smaller scale. I want to even say it was smaller than that. I think it was probably like 60 to 50,000 square feet. I'm forgetting, but it was much smaller. And, you know, a lot less ground to cover, a lot less real estate to worry about.
Got it. I know you may not be as like plugged into the industry these days, but have you heard anything about how it's been for sports facilities with everything happening right now with COVID and everything?
Yeah, it's largely a regional problem because a lot of these issues are state decisions that a lot of these the states make. So you're only beholden by the rules that the state gives you, right? So in Pennsylvania, I know they were, I think by summertime, if I'm not mistaken, summertime of 2020, as long as kids wore masks during competition, they were good. Oh, wow. And so there were competitions going on. And I think even now they still play with masks on within these competitions. So that was there, right? Texas, I mean, shut down, right? So I don't know how it was in California because I have connections in Texas and Pennsylvania still, but I know it varied from state to state. And overall, that industry took a hit. I mean, without a doubt, what industry didn't take a hit except for like, you know, what we're on now, Zoom, right? But real estate just took a hit overall. And it's unfortunate, but yeah.
Definitely. I'm sure they'll bounce back. So this is kind of an untapped industry as far as like the development side of it. Especially I was looking at people in our community because you're the first person I ever met who has done anything like this. And I know the path you took to it was pretty unique. So let's say someone listens to this and they're like, oh, wow, that seems pretty cool. Like, I want to get into developing sports complexes. What advice would you give? Like, where should that person start?
Yeah, I the advice that I used to give, you know, before I got into this industry is like, all right, you know, follow your passion. If you like sports, just do it. Like, right. But that's terrible advice, in my opinion. Now, it's a start. If you're passionate about sports, that's a start, right? But that can't be enough because there's just so many other factors that go into play. If you have a debt service you got to pay a landlord every single month, a huge nut of, you know, rent, and you got to make that rent up some way somehow, right? So my advice, frankly, if you wanted to get in this industry, I would start by running a program. I wouldn't start by trying to, you know, build a facility. If you really like basketball or soccer or whatever, start a soccer program, start a basketball program. Don't build a facility, right? Because there's a lot of those, and it's much more lucrative in terms of just finances to have a program and lease out space when you need it, as opposed to having a space and building a program around it, because there's a lot more liability with an actual facility. You have, you know, your utilities, your insurance, right? Your taxes, all that stuff you got to pay, whether people come through the door or not, right? right? If you have a program, your only issue is finding space for the amount of time that you need it, right? The hard part is getting people to come and play or whatever. But that, like, if you like it enough and you're good at it, like, that's fine. But that's my advice. And then if someone did want to take that next step, you gotta have your planning in place. Let's just assume you did your feasibility. You know what's gonna happen, all that. You gotta have planning. You gotta have people that are gonna bring individuals through the door. Whether that's, we talked about a capital stack. I think you need to have a good mix of programs. So like a program stack, you gotta have a good mix of rentals and tournaments and leagues and programming. Mix it all together to build your facility. I don't think relying on one is not financially viable in this day and age. You got a big soccer club that wants to rent all of your turf space. Well, what if that soccer club, one day just says, hey, we'll just go to the school. The school is charging us nothing, Hey, we'll just go outdoors because they're not charging us anything at the park, right? If you're beholden to, one rights holder, it's just never a good recipe. I've seen this happen too many times. So before that facility even hits the ground, before you open the doors, you should know exactly where the money's come from for the year.
Cool. Appreciate it. Man, this has been a pretty mind-blowing interview. I'm just thinking about, there's a place called Aviator in Brooklyn where we used to play at. Pay $10 or something. But I'm just, now in my mind, I'm thinking, I'm like, wow, like, I wonder how much they're making from this, how much they're making from that. So it's really cool. It's really cool. I'm excited for people to tap in and learn more about the sports complex space.
Yeah. I mean, they get down to knowing how many dollars are going to make per person that comes to the door. You can get that granular. And I think I advise people to get that granular, because then you're not surprised by anything. And that's the best business to run when there's no, surprises.
Definitely. So where can people find you if they like to just connect with you or learn more about what you have going on? What's the best way to do that?
Yeah. So I write a blog weekly, just about my thoughts, musings that I have. I actually spent one blog primarily on the sports facility just because I had a few guys actually come to me and say, hey, I want to open a facility. Cause I told them, oh, hold up, let me, let me tell you a little bit about what that all entails. So I write a blog. It's called Black Male White Paper. And then you can check me out on Twitter. I don't really tweet that much, but that's where all my links are. So it's at IBBMWP.
Cool. Are you on IG?
I'm not on IG. No, okay, cool. I try to stay as far as I can from social media because I feel like, my time here with my family is limited. So I got to maximize.
I hear you. Yeah, we'll definitely have those links in the show notes when this comes out. But yeah, is there any other last words you want to leave with the listeners?
Yeah, I'll say this. We talked a lot about team sports, but there's a ton of money to be made in individual sports as well. And I mean, the industry. So I know I talked about, hey, don't open a facility, but I think the industry is growing. I think in 2010, it was around 12 billion. I think the industry, it's currently at 19 billion today. And I want to say in about 5 years, it's projected to hit 75 billion. So it's ripe. I mean, this industry is still immature because there's a ton of parents who want their children to be good at sports so they can get a scholarship and go play on TV, right? So just keep that in mind. There's a ton of money to be made in this industry. You just got to be smart about how you approach it and really meticulous and plan it out.
Cool. Appreciate it. It was a pleasure having you on. I appreciate you coming on again, man. And to everyone, thank you so much for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. If you want to keep up with everything we have going on, the best way to do that is visit us at blackrealestatedialogue.com. If you would like to join us as an official patron, go to patreon.com/blackrealestatedialogue. Thank you so much. I look forward to hearing from you all soon.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. Remember to follow us on Instagram at Black Real Estate Dialogue and on Twitter at Bred Podcast. That's B-R-E-D Podcast. Until next time.
Introducing WonderSuite from Bluehost.com, the tool that makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and goals, and the WonderSuite tools will automatically lay out your WordPress website or store in minutes. Seriously. From there, you can customize your design, pick your brand colors, and add blocks. No custom theme or coding required. You'll get content suggestions that you can keep or revise. And with Yoast SEO built in, we automatically help you get found in search engines. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins to an AI-powered help bot, our built-in tools make WordPress wonderful for everyone. Whether you're a beginner or a pro, you can join over 2 million Bluehost users. Go to bluehost.com/wondersuite. That's bluehost.com/wondersuite.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.